P2ZO, your comment?
Just a comment on our ears and our frequency, how we hear. In fooling around with some of the audio processors I have, if you give yourself a little bit of a boost there at around the 460 hertz, and then, of course, another one up a little higher at 2800 or so, you get two things that are important to the human ear. One, the ability to recognize individuals, and that comes from the lower frequency. If you chop off that lower frequency, that 460 or so hertz, you lose the ability to identify people. But the peak up at 2600, 2800 is the point where you actually understand people. And it's interesting, if you play with something like that, the minute you knock out those high, and they're not real that high, 2600, 2800, you have trouble understanding. You can hear it, but you don't understand it. Interesting talk that Bob Heil gave one time on designing microphones and these things, and that's basically one of the things he said, is you got to have some amplification at both those frequencies. In fact, you can actually chop out the center. Give a bump on the bottom, give a bump on the top, and you're perfectly happy.
Comment.
Go ahead, Noel.
The program that's for noisy restaurants does what you're saying, because the speech therapists have discovered that. I have problems with woman consonants, because a lot of the intelligibility is in the second, third overtones, harmonics, what do you want to call it? Second and third. And so what happens is that's only 4% of the speech energy of your typical woman. And that's where a lot of the intelligibility is. So I have a program that's optimized for human speech in a noisy restaurant.
So here's the question. When you run the various programs, you run the one that's right for the environment, are actually you doing better than someone who's not wearing hearing aids at all?
Since my hearing loss is marginal, and I probably, I never noticed it, in fact, I hear men's voices nicely. The only problem is it came to my attention in the work environment, where one of my trainers noticed that I had missed something in a woman's. You know, she had said something, and I missed it. I missed what she had said. So I investigated further with an ENT in Hackensack, and then I went to a doctor of audiology, if you can believe such a thing exists. And then our things were $2,840 each. And the remote control, which is about the half the size of the cell phone, was another $250. And I could have had a choice. I could have had, my company could have monitored, monkeyed with the phone system here, which is one of the choices for reasonable accommodation. But when I found out that the insurance that I have is so good that they were 100% paid, I went for the hearing aids because I could use those in all different places. And the chances are, since my hearing is just slightly impaired with tinnitus and the roll-off of the higher frequencies, I would say it's possible, yes, in some situations, I would have an advantage over a normal human being's hearing because I'm cutting out the frequencies that are interfering with the hearing, and I have the normal, both ears are approximately the same, so I have binaural hearing, and so it's possible in many situations that I'm better off. And since I have a little button that is on a remote, which I happen to wear around my neck and clipped to my shirt, so I can click, you know, frequency back and forth between them real fast and make the vibe go up and down. In my fourth program, which is the one for the classical music, because there's no way I'd ever go to a concert without having the volume control, I have it set to 6 dB higher than normal. So if you ever watched a commercial with the little old lady holding the thing and listening to her near her neighbors, I think they call it the miracle ear, that's me. I can click that sucker up. And I can hear the kids in the pool party 3 blocks over.
Yeah, but you're not doing the cochlear implant thing, which is the other cool thing to do. All right. Very cool. Anybody else have any comments?
I have very selective hearing when with women's voices, especially when they're asking for money.
Given the number of women in your family, it's probably a good thing.
After I get the call, hey, Dad, could you? I just say, who's this?
My wife is an only child, and when she was in high school, she called home and said, hey, Daddy, and his answer was, who's this?
Yeah.
God is my witness, and she still tells that story with great glee. Now, I'm an only child. Who else is going to say, hey, Daddy? Yeah, anyway. Another thing. Anyway. Such is life. Oh, dear me. Okay. So, any other questions or comments for the net?
Got the other two.
All right, excellent. Let's go right ahead.
They both have to do with antennas, portable operation, semi-portable setups. I have those antenna poles, Army Scriplos, whatever they call them. They're about 4 foot long, 2.5 inches, 3 inches diameter, fiberglass. And I'm thinking, I saw Tony had made a mounting arrangement one time that you drove your vehicle on, and it held this thing rather rigid. The other choice is I could have somebody fabricate. I'm going to be up in an area where there's a good fabricator to hook onto a trailer hitch. Front bumper of my car has a step that's about a quarter inch aluminum that unfolds out, and I think Gordon and myself probably could both step on the step at the same time. Don and a few other people saw that at Kitsight. But that's the one question. The other question is, if I have a van, and it's a regular E250, and it has the normal metal up to the point where a normal E250 is, and then it has about 30 inches of fiberglass above that with the wood interior, not a lot of metal, just some. If I were to mount an HF antenna and, say, tune it, make it about 11 feet long, so it's tuned 15 meters, have a 3/8 in the end of it, so the antenna would mount on a vertical post at the rear of the vehicle. The antenna would have to have a fold over, so it would go forward at a height of about 24, 28 inches of the metal of the vehicle, and at the front of it have the 3/8 standard connector, and I'm thinking something like hamsticks, but this way I would have a tuned resonant antenna for each of the bands, and I just screw in a different hamstick type thing. The base antenna would be, of course, isolated, and the tuner would be inside the vehicle. That's one possibility. The other possibility is many people use basically a whip with an antenna tuner, high-range antenna tuner, right there at the base, and it's not resonant. And in that case, I would just take maybe put a 20-meter antenna, which is, what, about 16 feet, because that would fit nicely. I could run 20 meters mobile with a horizontal antenna, and when I flip the thing up, I could put a CB whip on it, and I would have basically, you know, a little bit longer than, what would that be, 8 feet? It would be like...
Repeater. Repeater. Timeout. Clear.
Okay. So, I guess your question is, which of these methods would you use, and how high do you want it? It really is a function of how high you want the mast to be, right?
The top of my van around the, 9 feet or something, so it'd be sort of on the side, and we don't want to put it on the passenger side because many times we've gone down these things and there's lots of trees and stuff that would catch. On the driver's side, not so much.
Right. So, are you proposing bolting this thing to the vehicle, or do you want there's something that you can, access and service? I'm trying to get my brain around. You talked about a lot of different things, but are you trying to get to the point where you can change out the antenna, or you just want to simply tilt it over for driving purposes and only have it usable when you're fixed and therefore extended vertically when you're fixed?
Well, I was going to think being able to drive with it on 20-meter position, for instance, and then fold it straight back up when I'm in a portable location for several hours and have it vertical at that point. So my thoughts are that's the possibility for that. The other thing is if I'm going to be in a location for a period of time and there doesn't have to be trees around, put up a mast and inverted A. Inverted V, what am I saying, A? It's an A, it's an inverted V. How do I keep it upright? Considering I have a van and I have one heck of a good strong bumper in the rear and a trailer hitch and a guy that's a artist with a welding. If you ever saw the ramp of my Dodge minivan, you know what I'm talking about.
Wait a minute. Go ahead. Hello, this is W2JEK. Yeah, you mentioned riding with a whip horizontal next to the metal part of your vehicle. I don't think that's going to work too good. If you have a whip, it has to be sort of in the clear, and the way you would talk, it would be held down with a ball mount or something at the rear of the vehicle. It would be 11 feet long, and it would be beyond that, it would be coming past the passenger compartment if you had a 20-meter whip on the end of that. I don't think that would work too good because most of your current is going to be in that lower section that's near the ball joint to the rear of your vehicle, so you're only about maybe 2 or 3 inches away from all that metal, so that would shield you a lot, I think. As far as going with the fiberglass mast, this article in QST has a as an arrangement with a pipe flange on a 4x4, and this particular fellow has a trailer that has a bumper that is a 4x4 just fits into his bumper, and he's got this pipe flange mounted on the 4x4, and he just slides that into this hollow square bumper, and he puts the pipe flange on that, and then he mounts his fiberglass mast on that, and he puts a beam on top of that for 20 meters. And it's apparently not that heavy for him. For actually riding on the air, that's a different kettle of fish altogether. Back to that, W2JK.
Don, the horizontal portion is 2 to 3 feet, not 2 to 3 inches. Away from the metal.
All right. Well, I think one of the things you want to think about is you want to have the mobile antenna, and maybe this begs the question to be different, two different solutions. You want a mobile antenna mount that you can roll down the road and just use, period, flat at the end, just leave it alone. So, if you want to mount it to the rear and above so that you can get the antenna up, that, I think that would be worth your while. You can use a ham stick, you can use any number of things. As long as it's got a good counterpoise underneath it, you're going to be in good shape. For the temporary mount, if you want to one thought you might consider is making a bracket that's above the hitch hall, above the, pardon me, the hitch, that you can reach and basically mount your antenna on a pole and have it fly through that sleeve and then basically keep feeding up those 4 foot pieces underneath it. And then when you're satisfied that it's high up enough, basically set it back down, just let it slide back down and into the ball mount so it doesn't kick out. But what I would think about is a bracket that has got some anti-torque capability. In other words, it's basically got some height to it and basically acts as a sleeve for the masting, and just basically slide the masting up through it. It's going to have to be large enough to accommodate the collets where the sections meet, but, you know, tight enough so that it doesn't wiggle too much in there. If you use the all-aluminum masting, it can be very, very smooth. If you use the fiberglass ones, they bulge out at the bottoms of the joints. So you might think to use the aluminum mast only as part of your slide-up, and maybe use a plastic section at the top to hold the antenna feed point if it's a dipole or a vertical or something like that. But that's something that came to mind that you could actually install from the ground, basically. Like you're just injecting another section of tubing underneath and just keep poking it up until you're not comfortable with its stability. And you could even guy it above that if you really wanted to, if you want it to be particularly high. That's what I've done in the past. Rather than try to just tilt over something really tall, I basically insert it from the bottom up and just...
Repeater. Repeater. Timeout. Clear.
No, my turn. I'm sorry.
Their suggestion was go to Midas, find a piece of pipe that was just as big as the bulgy parts, which are about 4 inches high, and locate the thing so that I had three of those. One at approximately welded to a ball or whatever. One straight up on a metal shaft of some sort that would be at a height that when the antenna came back down and sat into the bottom one, it would be at the wide flange part, and one up higher than that, and I would be able to feed it in because there would be approximately 5 feet between them, and the two upper ones would hold it wiggly, and I could feed one at a time up, and when it comes down, I could hold the top one and take one out at a time. And their suggestion was pipe, because if you got a pipe that just fits, then you could use that expander and make the top and bottom of the section. Say you got an 8-inch section of pipe. You could flare the top, you could flare the bottom, leave the center 4 inches to match the pipe, and you could have a reasonably tight fit. So that was an idea, yes. And this is Antonio.
Sure, you want to do three. I was just worried about your height, your ability to reach the top, the upper one, but if you can slide it all the way through from the bottom, that's fine. But if you want to fix like a dipole to that, you have to be able to get above the third one, and that might be a little tricky if it's too high.
That's what the rope and pulley is for. Once you get the thing up there, you pull whatever it is you want up using the pulley at the top and the rope.
Okay, so the top section of masting would always be engaged in the system. It would never, it would always be there, and that way you could have access to the top no matter what. Sitting through the second one. That's a good idea. If you wanted to put a fixed antenna on top, of course you'd have to have you'd have to have a ladder to get to the top of that, or maybe you can use the ladder on the vehicle to do that. So, yeah, sure, why not? That works for me. Anybody else have any comments? Okay, Noel, your third question.
And that was it. So that was the two questions. So I'm done. And to William.
Okay, well, I have something to tell you about. We've all made these copper J-poles, and we had a conversation a couple of months back where people were commenting that if you make a twin lead J-pole and you stick it inside PVC, it'll detune it, and requiring an adjustment of your measurements, et cetera, and the resonant point and all that good stuff. And, you know, I was a little skeptical of that, but okay, fine. Well, the other day, we were making copper J-poles, and we were having a hell of a time getting a good match on a 2-meter copper J-pole made with half-inch copper tubing. Could not, for the life of us, figure out what the hell was wrong. We had, like, 6 feet of RG8X, you know, that had been used to feed it. I think we started with 12 or 15 feet and cut it in half and stripped it back. And, you know, we tried coiling up the wire. We tried using ferrites. And coiling the wire was a good start, but improving things. The ferrites were not very effective, even though they were the right kind of ferrites. But what we ended up discovering was the little piece of metal underneath the sideways T had to be insulated from a human being. You couldn't just hold it over your head and expect it to work unless you had some form of insulation, because there were apparently ground effects from the person holding the aluminum pipe below the feed point. Even though they say it's isolated, it really isn't. And so the plumber's delayed construction that people advocate may be fine, but it's highly suggestive of a need to insulate those J-poles. So that's what we ended up doing with a piece of a Delrin rod, if you can believe it. And let me give you set the context of this. I was asked by my company to get kids excited about being engineers and teach them about some of our services at AT&T. So I was doing that, and I said, well, but how are we really going to get them excited? Just, you know, blah, 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 doing this stuff. So, you know, I took my passion for amateur radio and added another day's worth of program, a day and a half's worth of program to my couple-hour lecture on our services. So the kids in the class each made a J-pole, got them a tour of the league, which is the same tour you'd get, operating time at W1AW, and then after lunch we spent time building copper J-poles in the lab. The only thing the league required was that they do the torch work, because they didn't want anybody other than an employee, you know, in the lab doing the torch work. But they did the torch work right in the lab. It was great. So we had a great time, and it was a lot of fun. And we learned that insulating your J-pole really, really does help get a good match, because we couldn't get it below 1.9 at all, and until we simply insulated the bottom from ourselves, and magically we got 1.2, 1.3, maybe 1.4 if you were sloppy. So it was kind of amazing how the match improved immediately. Then the kids used the antennas, to demonstrate to themselves how much more effective a copper J-pole was than, let's say, a factory antenna for an HT. You know, they were truly impressed about the signal-to-noise ratio differences, and they actually took some measurements. It was kind of neat. So all was good. We had a great experience at the league and such. They also liked packet radio because it reminded them of texting, which kind of tells you something. They thought it was really, really neat that the waterfall display on PSK-31, they thought that the voices from afar were kind of neat, both at the leak station and on mine. I bought one of my little orange boxes and with the IC-7000 and the DR-135 with the packet capability, so that all was working. They really thought that was jazzy. Let's see, what was the other thing I wanted to mention? Oh, yes, I got to sit down in front of a 7700. And Jim, S2K, I understand why you like your 7700. It was really neat for me as a Pro 3, Pro 2, 746 Pro user, even 7000 user, to sit down and just kind of intuitively find and exercise the noise blanker. So there's an AC line noise problem in the leak neighborhood, and throwing all kinds of hash across 40 meters, and I was able to knock it down real fast, and what a very effective noise blanker that 7700 has, to say the least. It's so good, it's too bad there's not a 12-volt power supply for that radio. Hi. Any comments from anybody, please call K2BAR.
My 7600's got that same blanker, and it's very good.
Oh, you bought a 7600?
We had it at Kit Night the other night, and I was amazed at how good the blanker is. No distortion, you're not like some of the others, and it works quite well.
Yeah, I thought it was, on the order of my Pro 3s, but maybe a tad better. But the 7600 seemingly is a nice radio. Maybe someday. Right now I've got the Pro 3 and the Pro 2. I'm very content with that. But maybe when Jeremy's out of college, I'll jump for something like that. We'll see. But who knows? But very, very nice. I didn't realize you had a Pro 2. I mean, I had a 7600, Jim. That's great. I know NS2K has a 7700. They're real nice radios. I actually got to use a 7600 last summer. Pardon me, at HRO in Atlanta, but I never really got a chance to really discern its capabilities quite to the level that I would have liked to. So very, very nice. Very nice. Any additional comments?
I sold 4 amplifiers and 2 transceivers to get it.
Yeah, well, yeah. And what was the price when you finally got it delivered to your door?
Gene KJI sells it for just under $3,900.
Yowzer. Yep. Which 2 transceivers did you part with?
A TS-850 and a Yaesu 920.
Good choices to sacrifice to the latest and greatest gods. Very nice. And you care to discuss the amplifiers?
Well, one of them was a Henry 2K. Another one was an Ameritron. And another one was a Heathkit.
Well worth it. Good for you. Very, very good. They're really sweet radio. I just feel very blessed with what I have here, but I wouldn't cry over a 7600. my. I still like the 12-volt thing. The 7700, I've got this mental block on that because of the 12-volt thing, but 7600 would definitely be in the radar. But then again, I never thought I'd own a Pro 3, so let me put it that way. So, to go back to the other topic a little bit, it was kind of neat to just remind oneself that you need to insulate yourself from those antennas when you're trying to tune them up and when you're trying to use them, because getting the best match really requires you get away the human effects, and one of those is grounding the darn thing with your body, so don't do that. All right, any other comments?
Gordon?
Yeah, Jim, go ahead.
8270. I sent you a file last week because I thought you were going to be running the net, and I brought up some comments on this interface that I built. Did you see that file?
Oh, my God, no. I did not, and I apologize profusely. You sent me a file last Thursday?
Yeah, I sent you a PDF of a data sheet of HSR 412. And we discussed it last week on the TechNet. And what came up was a situation similar to what you had with interfacing to a negative going radio amplifier.
Yeah.
If you remember, the one I built for you, I built with a commercial solid-state relay, which was a little bit overkill, but it worked. But you had the negative going voltage. Well, I have somebody, one of the fellows in the club, that Jim, KC2BRY, has the same problem with an SB200, and his radio only wants to take a positive voltage to, with the open collector to ground. Anyway, I found this Fairchild chip, paid $1.25 for it, bought a couple of them, and it's got two FETs. It'll switch a couple of hundred volts at 200 amps, 200 mils, and it's just got a LED, LED to drive it. So I just take 12 volts out of the radio, series resistor, loop it through the LED, bring it back to the open collector to ground, and this thing will switch. And in this particular one that I built, I paralleled the two FETs, so it'll handle like 300-400 volts at 400 mils. And it works quite well. Cost $1.23.
That sounds lovely. I'm looking through last Thursday's email, and I'm not seeing it. I apologize, but for whatever reason, it's not here, Jim. I never got it. You sent it to w2ttt@att.net?
I think I did. Let me go see what I sent it to you.
You give me the time and date you sent it. I'm curious because I don't see it here on Thursday at all. I get a lot of mail, but I haven't, unless I inadvertently deleted something, which is technically possible, but I don't know when's the last day. I did empty my bin since then, but I'm going to check Wednesday as well. But anyway, it sounds like a wonderful circuit. You know, nothing simpler than a couple of FETs in parallel and away you go. You know, how lovely is that? It's a great idea. I'm kind of curious if anybody else has any other applications for things like that. And, I'm kind of curious, actually, next time Jim comes back also, there's, you know, even though it'll handle 300-400 volts, there's no reason why it couldn't handle just a 12-volt closure, too. I mean, you know, in other words, basically use it to gate far lower voltages in lieu of a relay. Wouldn't that be nice as well?
Yeah, well, you don't want to use a relay because that slows things down. But I'm trying to find out where it was here. I sent it to you. I'll find it again here and resend it. But, yeah, it's got two FETs, and they have their one side, their negative side, they're connected, and they've got a diode across them. So you could actually make this thing, using the two FETs in series, a AC or DC switcher, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. You use it in lieu of a relay because of the speed and also the effective isolation still there. That's really neat. I would like that circuit. That would be very, very excellent. Kind of curious if anybody else has any comments on this subject. That's a really neat idea to use a couple of FETs for this.
Yeah, well, we had a couple of good comments last week there when we were discussing it.
Care to recap for those of us who weren't there?
Talking about the problem with interfacing an amplifier, this fellow bought a third-party device, and of course the guy who was selling it had no idea that there were amplifiers out there that had a negative going voltage, like the SP200 and the Collins 30S1, and 30L1, I should say. And of course, I guess there's a few that do, but you know, that it wouldn't work. And he scratched his head, and even the guy that sold it didn't know the answer. So anyway, we came up with this little idea to do this, and it worked quite well.
Yeah, I would think so. What a really neat idea. Just keep things real simple with a simple gating device like that. Goes negative and you're good to go. Yeah, the Collins, the let's see what else does that? Do you think Collins, Heathkit, if somebody else has one of these that same problem? I can't remember anyway. It's certainly those are the two high runners though in that category.
The other one that's a problem is the NCL2000, which is actually an AC switch.
Oh, there you go. Well, actually, I was thinking that the only thing, before you mentioned the NCL, the NCL amp or national amp, is a lot of the old transceivers had AC switches, too. I'm trying to remember if my Apache transmitter had that. I don't think the Marauder did. I think that had a negative going high voltage DC input, but I think the Apache might have had an AC switching input for to put into transmit.
Yeah, because it was designed to use an external Dalkey relay.
Yalta, there you go. Exactly right. Those were fun days. I'm so glad we don't have to relive them. Yeah, I give it a lot of credit to these guys who like to restore old radios and keep them working and make it all pretty. And, you know, that their shack must glow in the dark and generate heat, otherwise they're not happy. I mean, God bless them, because there's a lot of value in that. And it really is. But man, do I really, really want, you know, 300 volts necessary to put my to engage my transmitter, let alone the other miscellaneous power supplies voltages that are running around inside that transmitter? You know, everything from, you know, 6.3 volts to maybe 6.0 or 5 volts to, you know, negative this at 100 some odd volts to, you know, 400 volts with the screens, and oh, by the way, you know, maybe 1200 volts or maybe even a few thousand volts on the plates. It's like, God, do we really miss this? I ask you.
Oh, I guess some of us do. We just reset that file to you. It's ATT, that address that I sent it to.
Okay. I'll try to see if before we go whether it pops in. Anyway, I just want to let everybody know that Ed Hare and Mike Gruber and a few other guys were having a great time. By the way, he also got a complaint from a guy in the Midwest, who was a AT&T customer who was basically killing his own service with his ham radio. And it turns out that the guy had a couple of things going on, but his wife wouldn't let him have wires across the property. So he took his wife's requirement literally and put up a full-wave 80-meter loop. and inside it, sharing the same feed point, he put in a trigonal loop of around 4.5 megahertz for Mars operation. So he fed it with some abundant amount of 450 ohm ladder line, and then it came to a balun inside the shack, and then the balun to a 4-to-1 balun to then an antenna tuner. But the ladder lines actually entered the shack. So he was impacting one of his TV sets, but not the other. And I listened to his tale of woe. And when he got done, I had to make some experiments. So I said, well, where are you operating now? He says, well, let me try 4.5 megahertz, and there's some issues with DSL and 4.5 megahertz. But sure enough, he killed his video DSL in the one television, but not the other, which was a little odd, but okay, fine. And then I had him try 3.3 megahertz, which is the other Mars frequency, and he wasn't getting full power output, but I could see he was impacting his service, but it was still operating correctly. I could see it with my instrumentation. I couldn't see, it was not affecting his user quality. Even though basically the system showed his robustness was enough to keep him working fine. But then I had him go back to 4.5 megahertz because I wanted to see if there was an issue with the other television, and it turned out not to be. But because he had to retune his tuner, magically the problem that had originally inspired his complaint went away, and all he had to do would adjust his antenna tuner, and the problem went away. So, lesson learned: when in doubt, retune your tuner. It was fascinating to watch this, but that's all he did ultimately to fix his problem. Case closed, good deal. And he had done a lot of bypassing, and the company had done a lot of other things, like buried, shielded, dropped to his house, and a few other things. But it was a standard city lot, in the Midwest, and all is well now. So I thought that was kind of cool. But the lesson is, if you have RFI issues, check your grounding, make sure your connections are good, and above all, retune your tuner. Any comments on that? The call came to the air. Alrighty. I don't have any more. Does anybody have any more comments or questions for the net? Please call K2B Air. I want to thank everybody for a great time. Some of you will get together. Most of us, I guess, will be at the Barra picnic on Sunday. Some of us will be at the Bicycle Tour of New Jersey bike ride. We're meeting at 7 a.m. on Sunday. If you can spare the day, I'd really appreciate it. And we're doing real well. And it's been a great week of ham radio and work and all sorts of other things. So I want to thank everybody for participating and hearing each other's questions and answering them, and also commenting on what I had to say as well. So this is K2BAR. For the Bergen Amateurs Association, thanking the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club for the use of their repeater, and wishing everybody a fine good evening. And this is W2TTT signing clear. 73.
NS2K, you still around? K2ZO.
You may have dozed off and gone to sleep.
Probably has. Okay. 73.
73, Jim. Enjoy, and I'm charging up radios in preparation for the weekend. Loads of fun. SDK, though. I mean, WK2ZO, W2TTT. I'm somewhat envious of your new toy, by the way. Very cool. W2TTT.
I just went and mined the garage.
You mined the garage. Yeah? Huh? Something to be said for that.
So
sold a lot of junk.
Yep. And provided people with newfound treasures for their own use.
Sold a lot of good stuff, too. But, yep, had to go. And, yeah, I like the radio. It's very nice. Got a lot of neat features on it, especially the roofing filters. It's pretty amazing to stick the 6KC roofing filter in, put it on AM in the broadcast band, put the 6KC band pass on, as well as the 6KC filter, and just tune around and find a station every 10KC and not be bothered by the big guys next door.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I do that with my Pro 3 and sometimes my Pro 2. It's good. It's not that good.
Well, the roofing filter does make a big difference. But, yeah, it's pretty nice radio. Still learning. Catch you later. W2TTT, K2ZO.
Yeah, a way to figure out what you can do with either or both of those two USB ports. I think that's the real jewel of that radio, as far as interfacing. And then, you know, the quality of the RF deck, like starting with the roofing filter, is just really amazing. 73K2ZO, W2TTT, I'll be in the shack for a few.
W2MW.
Is that H2MW?
Just on my way home from work, so thought I'd jump in and say good evening to you. Just, I know you were off doing something there.
Yeah, hi, Kurt. Yep. We're hanging out here. We're having a grand old time, making things work around here. Hey, I have a question for you. Speaking of your past pedigree, would you like to come and work a public service event on Sunday, a bike ride here in North Jersey?
I have some commitments that I have to deal with, so although I'd love to do that, you know, if it wasn't for that, I'd be there.
I understand. I understand big time. No big deal. I just discussed with Jim, K2ZO. He got rid of a bunch of stuff he had sitting around, and he bought himself an IC 7600. And I got to use the 7700 and quite a bit of detail the other day for about maybe an hour. And being a Pro 3 user, it was quite a step up. and he's got the 7600, which has a lot of things out of the 7700, so very cool as well. Anyway, are you on your way home?
I'm just about ready to get off my exit here. I'm on Route 9A, or actually Route 9, getting out of Route 9A up here in Montrose. So, but yeah, I heard that whole discussion. Unfortunately, I'm so far out of touch in terms of what's the latest and greatest in the way of HF gear. It's really, it's just not all that familiar, you know. Jim had mentioned that he had sold an FT920. Well, that's my primary radio at this point, which hasn't seen the light of day in the past couple of years, unfortunately. So, but you also mentioned going to the league, and I heard you know, a good piece of that as well. And that sounded pretty exciting. Yeah, that must have been a lot of fun. Yeah, I try to get to the league every year with the illustrious three Steves, 2IFA, KF2TI, and KB2ENF. Join them with their three Steves and a Kurt amateur radio adventures at the league. So that's a lot of fun. And of course you get to play with, you know, whatever's new out there. So W2CTT from W2MW.
You mean one of those being the illustrious Steve Zlotnick?
Would be one and the same, yep, sure. That'd be N2IFA.
No, I know who he is. Actually, I know all of them. But, yeah, well, what do you call it? I remember when he was still in school and his brother was as well. In fact, his brother married Sue Friedman, and Sue's brother Michael was my best man, and I was an usher in his wedding. Michael and I know each other since we were teenagers. God, that was a long time ago.
I hear it. We exchanged a series of emails and whatnot, and last year we weren't able to make it to the league due to just the conflict in schedules and whatnot, so hopefully this year we'll be able to resurrect that activity. So the other thing, might just have an opportunity to operate from a Kilo Papa 2 station at the end of the month, so I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, really? Someplace exotic, or someplace just exotic by its prefix?
I would say it's someplace exotic. A fellow friend of mine, ham radio operator, whatnot, who lives down in St. Croix. I'm heading down to St. Thomas for a week with my fiance, and we are going to just do it all up. We're going to be all over the place, and one of which is to meet up with Brian and Ann, who live down in St. Croix, and have an HF station and whatnot. So I'm looking forward to that. That would be a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, absolutely. What a really cool idea. Just to get some operating time. Does your fiance understand that ham radio has to rate, and that, you know, when circumstances allow, there's going to be wires across and antennas, dry banders, things like that in your future?
She knows it. She's seen it. And in fact, the last home QTH that I had a mini G5 up, and had a blast working all sorts of places, including Peter Island when they were on the air a number of years back. So, it's all part of the scheme. She's aware of it. She's embraced for it, so. I'm just kind of anxious to get the HF rig back out on the air again. I really do miss that. The evenings I used to spend, I like one of those archaic modes like CW, and I'll just spend hours and hours and hours just fooling around the bands. One of my favorite bands is 30 Meters. In fact, when I go to the league with the three Steves, you'll find me on 30 Meters just off the bottom, and putting in several hundred cues in the period of time we operate there. To me, that's just a pile of fun.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I've been pretty blessed. Nancy likes ham radio. She likes ham radio different than I do, but she likes the whole family likes public service events, so that helps a lot right there. In fact, our final ham radio event for the whole family will be this Sunday, because John goes in the Navy the week after, on the 23rd, and James is going to be there as an EMT, but he's also going to be helping out with, he's going to be the communications liaison for the medical staff. It's kind of neat, and the little guy's, he's developing somewhat differently than his brothers in the way his interest in ham radio. He's somewhat more resistant to it at some level, but he's getting into the public service event thing because his mother is dragging him by his ankles to be with her, which is fine. It works for me. And then, what do you call it? My wife and I, you know, we've loved doing this stuff for years. The older boys do too. But, so we've got a lot to do, at this event. We're trying to get enough operators going. You know how that is.
No, as I said, if it wasn't for this commitment, you know, that was something that I truly enjoyed, especially when I lived down at Oak Ridge and was a radio officer for the town. And in fact, I was the radio officer for the town during 9/11 and stationed there for, geez, I would have to say, probably about 15 hours or so. 15 to 20 hours, you know, just playing, you know, just talking to the EOC talking to county EOC, police station. That was a lot of fun. Well, unfortunately, it was a sad situation, but I had just pulled in sitting here apart, so have to help find even.
Okay, Kurt, very good. Nice hearing you, and glad you jumped in. Try to keep this repeater lively on Thursday nights, and now that I'm back from the jamboree and miscellaneous other things, it'll, I expect it will be lively for a little while longer. So 7-3 and have a good one. N2HTC, probably N2HTC, what am I doing? W2MW, W2TTT, Godspeed.